Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're peeling back the layers on something. Well, something really fundamental to public trust, how policing success is actually measured. We're doing a deep dive into a recent New York City Council analysis of the NYPD's crime reporting data. And we're zeroing in on this really slippery metric known as the clearance rate.
It's a number you hear all the time, but almost no one knows what's actually in it.
Exactly. So our mission for you today is to get you past the headlines. We're unpacking sources that reveal these huge flaws in methodology, but also bigger analytical gaps.
Right.
We need to understand that chasm between correlation to things happening at the same time and causation, where one thing actually causes the other. Mm. You know, is the crime drop from a smart strategy or just something else entirely?
And that distinction is just, it's paramount. Because the integrity of this data, it's inseparable from governance, from accountability.
Yeah.
The council analysis and the critiques we've looked at, they really challenge that conventional narrative.
The one we always hear.
Yeah, the one you hear in every press conference. That falling crime rates are because of one specific police strategy. If the data itself is flawed, the claims built on it just can't hold up.
Okay, so let's start there. Let's start with the immediate problem the council found. The clearance rate itself. In theory, it's simple, right?
It should be.
It's the proportion of reported crimes that get resolved or cleared, usually by an arrest, maybe a charge, within a certain amount of time. It's supposed to be a clean measure of efficiency.
So it's to be.
But the council's analysis, which looked at practices before 2024, found this spectacular flaw in how it was being calculated.
Yeah.
They found that the NYPD's old method was to take all the arrests made in, say, a quarter, and divide that number by the complaints filed in that same quarter.
And that's the whole problem right there. The issue is, those arrests, they might be for a crime that was reported last month or last year,
mm-hmm.
or even 5 years ago.
Wait, so just to make sure I'm following this.
Go ahead.
They were counting solved cold cases right alongside current cases, but measuring all of that against only the new complaints from this quarter.
Exactly. You got it. It's mixing apples and oranges. The result is just... it's mathematical absurdity.
And this is where it gets really interesting. Because this practice, it distorted the data so much that it sometimes led to clearance rates over 100%.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that for a second. You've mathematically proven you solved more crimes than were even reported in that window.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not just a broken metric. That's like a statistical magic trick.
It absolutely warps the picture. The council's report had this one perfect example that just laid it all bare.
Okay, what was it?
They looked at the murder clearance rate in Manhattan. This was for the fourth quarter of 2023.
Right.
When they did the math properly, you know, only counting arrests for crimes that happened in that quarter, the clearance rate was 69.2%.
Boy, respectable number.
A respectable number. But then when they used the old flawed method, including arrests for crimes from previous quarters.
What did it jump to?
That 69.2% skyrocketed to 130.8%.
Whoa, 130%. So a police department announces a 130% clearance rate, and the media runs with it. Historic success.
Of course they do. But the reality underneath is that they actually cleared less than 70% of that quarter's murders. It completely obscures what's happening right now.
And you can't tell if the department is solving new crimes quickly or just finally getting around to closing old ones.
Exactly. It makes real evaluation.
Yeah.
Or even just planning where to put resources. Totally impossible.
So the council finds this huge flaw, and that leads to legislation to fix it. This brings us to Introduction 1237A.
Right. Sponsored by Councilmember Oswald Feliz. This is the solution.
And what does this bill actually demand? It seems like a huge step.
It is. It mandates that the NYPD post comprehensive incident-level data for all complaints and arrests, going all the way back to 2007.
And when you say incident-level, you mean getting really granular.
Super granular. We're talking exact location, date, time, the nature of the offense. But here's the crucial part. It also requires demographic info for victims, suspects, arrestees, and the specific date of resolution.
Why are those details, the demographics, the geography, why do they matter so much?
Well, as Councilmember Feliz put it, without that detail, you can't shine a light on disparities. When all you have is this big aggregate number, crime went down 10% citywide, you can't see if it went down everywhere equally.
Or if the clearance rate for violent crime is, say, way lower in one community than another.
Precisely. This new law shifts the data from being, you know, a kind of shield for PR and turns it into a real operational tool. It's about who is affected, where it's happening, and whether justice is equitable.
It's moving from just counting things to actually understanding them.
That's the whole idea. Transparency becomes the first step to equity.
Okay, so we've established the foundation is cracked. The numbers themselves were misleading. But the sources we reviewed point to a deeper, almost cultural problem, this constant tendency to turn correlation into causation.
It's the biggest analytical sin in this field. And look, let's be clear about the baseline fact, which is good news. Crime has declined.
Right.
Across the U.S., in New York City, post-pandemic. That is an uncontested fact.
But when an official stands up and says, crime is down, therefore our new strategy X worked, they're skipping what, like 10 steps of analysis?
They're skipping the most important one. You have to look at the external benchmark, FBI data.
And what does that show?
It shows crime reductions across the country in places with totally different policing models, different politics, different enforcement philosophies. New York's experience, while positive, fits right into that national pattern.
So if crime is falling everywhere, even in cities that say cut police budgets or tried non-carceral approaches, how can anyone definitively claim that a specific local strategy caused the decline here?
That's the question that rarely gets asked. The public discourse just collapses two different ideas. There's descriptive stats, what happened, crime went down, and then there's causal inference, what made it happen. And that requires a much higher standard of proof.
And you can't ignore all the other things going on. I mean, the confounding variables.
Huge variables.
Yep.
Economic conditions, demographic shifts, changes in prosecutions, social services, and just, you know, a general return to normal after the pandemic.
So any one of those things could be driving the trend.
Or all of them together. To say one local police tactic moved that giant needle, it ignores this whole complex web of forces. It's just an assertion, not an established fact.
So let's get into the methodological heart of this. If these claims of success rely on assertion, what's the actual evidence that's missing? What's the academic standard that isn't being met here?
It really boils down to four major failures of methodology. The first, and maybe the biggest, is the failure to use control or comparison groups.
Okay, explain what a control group means in this context.
A control group answers the question, what would have happened otherwise? If the NYPD tries a new strategy in precinct A, they need a precinct B, a similar precinct, where they don't use the strategy.
Oh, I see.
Only if crime drops significantly more in precinct A than in precinct B, can you even start to claim the strategy worked.
So without that comparison, a statement like, crime fell 15% after we started this, is it's basically meaningless.
Analytically, yes. You can't isolate the effect. Mm. The second failure is relying on short-term volatile analysis. So many of these claims are based on drops over just like 3 to 6 months.
And why is that unreliable?
Because crime data is just naturally volatile. It bounces around. You can have a really bad spike 1 month, which leads to a big intervention. Mm-hmm. And then the next month, the rate just naturally falls back to normal. It's a statistical thing called regression to the mean. Extreme events tend to be followed by more moderate ones.
Okay, so let me see if I get this. If a precinct has, say, 5 murders... when it usually has one, it's almost statistically guaranteed to go down the next month, even if the police did absolutely nothing new.
That's a perfect example. A 3-month drop after a spike isn't proof. It's often just noise. You need multi-year analysis to see a real trend.
Got it. And the third failure seems kind of obvious. The lack of independent evaluation.
It's huge. The sources point out that these claims are almost always internally generated and validated. It's the institution grading its own homework.
And deciding the curve.
Yeah. There's no external audit, no academic review. There's just a powerful incentive to find success, whether it's rigorously proven or not.
And the final one is what we already touched on, failing to account for national trends.
Correct. If crime is falling everywhere, you can't treat your local drop as exceptional without adjusting for that national baseline. It's misleading to present a coincident trend as a local achievement.
So when you put all four of those failures together, what does that tell you? The language we hear, data-driven deployment, precision strategies?
It's branding. It functions as powerful branding. It's a managerial rhetoric that substitutes the feeling of confidence for the hard work of causation.
Let's shift now to the consequences of all this, because this isn't just an academic debate. It affects real people, real communities.
Absolutely.
And first, you have to look at the media's role. the sources describe legacy media as a narrative multiplier.
It's a huge problem. They often just repeat the institutional assertions from press releases without asking these tough methodological questions.
So a headline reads, "Police chief credits new task force for crime drop," and that implies causation, even if there's zero proof.
Exactly. It allows the institution to define its own success, and the public is left thinking the case is closed, when really it was never even made.
And when these unproven narratives replace actual evidence, that's where the civil rights implications get really stark. First, they're used to rationalize aggressive policing.
Yes. A tactic, like a new task force that does a lot of stops, gets a presumption of necessity. It's framed as what works. It's given legitimacy, even if its effectiveness has never been rigorously tested.
And the cost of that aggressive enforcement is not borne equally?
Never. It falls on the same communities that have always faced the highest levels of police scrutiny.
And the second point here is how this aggregate data can obscure disparate impacts.
This is so critical. When you only report the top line number, the citywide clearance rate is up. You flatten all the inequality into one success story. You mask the unequal outcomes.
So the overall clearance rate could be, say, 80%. But if you dug into the data,
you might find it's 95% for victims in wealthy neighborhoods and only 50% for victims in low-income neighborhoods.
And that's exactly the kind of detail Introduction 1237A is designed to expose.
That's the entire point. That granular data makes those disparities impossible to hide. And what's so fascinating is how the critique frames this. It's not just a PR problem for the police. It's a governance failure.
A governance failure.
You can't have equitable public safety when the power being used is justified by numbers that are, at best, unproven, and at worst, fundamentally compromised.
This has been an incredibly challenging deep dive. The core tension is just. It's undeniable. The reduction in crime is real. That's a good thing.
A very good thing.
But the causal story that's attached to it, it remains largely unproven. It's relying on correlation, not the kind of evidence that would meet any real scientific standard.
And that's why the NYC Council's action here, passing 1237AA, is so important. It's a vital step. It forces the creation of the data you need to finally do an honest evaluation.
So transparency is the starting point.
It's the beginning, not the end, of accountability. It gives outside analysts and the public the raw material to finally test these powerful, longstanding claims.
So we'll leave you with a final thought to consider based on what we've unpacked today. The real measure of effective policy isn't just whether crime went down. It's whether we know, with analytical rigor, if the policy we chose was the actual reason. In the absence of that proof, without the control groups, without the independent review, the questions always remain. Who really benefits from the strategy? Who bears the costs? And who gets to decide what success even looks like? We'll see you next time.